Your first eight guys maybe should be blue plate specials, but those back five guys, they should be more like tin hats, more guys that are grunt players, garbage players that dive for the ball.
You are listening to the Scrambled Eggs Podcast on CrackSidewalks.com.
Hi, everyone, and welcome into Scrambled Eggs, your unofficial Marquette basketball podcast here on CrackSidewalks.com. Joe McCann, Phil Bush here with you once again, and we are going to talk Marquette basketball in just a minute, but I feel like we would be remiss if we did not at least touch on the story that has dominated the sports world over the last 48 hours. The death of Kobe Bryant dominated my Twitter timeline like no story really ever has. And Phil, I don't know about you, it was one of those things. I was still thinking about it on Monday. Like normally with, you know, like I remember Michael Jackson's death and Prince's death, and they shook me, and there were other celebrity deaths that shook me. But by the time my head hit the pillow that night, I was kind of ready to move on. But I was still thinking about Kobe's death on Monday. It was just such a shocking thing, and even some of the Marquette players were, and Coach Wojo was talking about it on Monday. It's just, it's something I'm never going to forget, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's both the kind of the tragic nature of it, especially given, you know, it included both Kobe and his daughter and the rest of those folks that were on the helicopter. And I think Kobe was kind of one of the first athletes, because I was trying to explain this to my parents, because my parents were like, well, yeah, I mean, obviously we knew who that was, but we didn't realize he was that big a deal or whatever. I think he was just one of the, but when you know, because he came in the NBA in like 96, we were in high school, but that was like, you know, kind of when he was starting into his mid-late prime, that's when YouTube and some of the social media stuff, and he just kind of became ever present from a social media awareness standpoint. Like, he was one of those, the first superstars to really be that way. Like, everyone knew Jordan, but Kobe was, and let's be honest, Kobe as a player was, in a good way, was divisive, right? Like, there were, you know, there were pro Kobe and con Kobe, especially yeah, late in his career, and it just, you know, it was part of the landscape.
And two of those guys tried to fight each other in Temecula once upon a time.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, like, I think the big thing with Kobe, and we're not going to break it down too much because I think there's been plenty of coverage out there, who people who know far more about him.
Yeah, and much more qualified people to talk about it than us.
But the only two things I'll say is, one, Kobe is just such a great ambassador for basketball of all levels. Men and women, from the pros down to the youth levels. I mean, he had his Mamba Academy, which was tragically where he was taking those people on that fateful Sunday. And, you know, I had just run a story on Sports Stars of Tomorrow the day before, like, about a high school girl in Cashmere, Washington, which is like 2 hours east of Seattle, that Kobe had befriended and, like, went to her game. Like, that just kind of shows me, like, it wasn't just a show with him. Like, he actually cared about the next generation coming up. And I think that's what resonated with a lot of people. And the other thing I'll say is, so many players who are playing basketball now, both in the NBA and WNBA and in college, like, Kobe is the one they grew up watching. Because all, you know, like, the youngest ones, like, they were born, like, 2000, 2001, 2002, and you know, a lot of the younger stars in the NBA were born in the late 90s, so they don't really remember watching Jordan at all. And like you said, like, Kobe kind of came around when social media and YouTube kind of became more and more popular. So many people who are prominent figures in basketball now grew up idolizing Kobe. So anyone who really has a big opinion about basketball, like, Kobe is their OG. And that, I think that's why it resonated so hard with so many people, and it's like I said, it's just a story that just dominated the headlines, and just, I don't know what else to say other than condolences to everybody who lost someone in that tragedy. And yeah, it's something that people are going to be thinking about and remembering him for the rest of this basketball season. And he's in the Hall of Fame class. Like, he's up for election in March, and he will certainly be a unanimous selection along with Tim Duncan. And there was somebody else really prominent that's going in this class.
Unless the Derek Jeter voter is
yeah, right. It's Garnett. It's Garnett, Duncan, and Kobe.
Oh my god, that is a Hall of Fame class. Jesus.
Yeah. So yeah.
The last like kind of anecdotal thing I'll mention like for Kobe is like I played a lot of pickup basketball, and other than you and I and some of our friends making references to employee number 8, an Antoine Walker joke. in the later years, one of the things culturally in pickup basketball that like was like just universal was somebody would jack up a crazy shot and everyone else would yell Kobe, right? Like it was kind of
people
like
people do that throwing paper in the trash can,
right? It's like the Leroy. It was like Leroy Jenkins before Leroy Jenkins.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But he will always be iconic, and there are even people trying to make a push to change the NBA logo from Jerry West to Kobe if Jerry West gets his blessing. And I wouldn't be opposed, but that seems like an emotional reaction, but we'll see what the NBA does, whether it's retiring his number in perpetuity or whatever and whatnot. But again, this is a Marquette basketball podcast. I just felt like we should at least mention an iconic figure in the world of basketball, especially, you know, even Marquette, like I said, Marquette players and Wojo were talking about Kobe on Monday. But we are here to talk about Marquette basketball on this podcast to kind of get back to business as we look ahead to Marquette's next couple games. I dare say this podcast might be a little deeper than some of our other ones, Kobe Bryant tribute aside, because we actually, I think
prepared.
Both you... Yeah, I dare say we prepped a little bit for this, because I think both you and I had some, like... I think all sports fans can resonate with this. Maybe you have a take on something, but you don't have data to back it up. But then you're afraid, like, you give this take and somebody hits you with data and says, well, actually, you're really wrong here. Like, somebody says, well, Aaron Rodgers is really bad in the fourth quarter. And then somebody says, well, actually, look at these numbers. You're terribly wrong about that. I'm like, oh, I guess I just felt he was. I think both you and I had some opinions, some takes we want to bring into this podcast. But I think we both wanted to have some data to back it up so nobody said, hey, that thing you said about Wojo, this is what it actually is, right? Like,
right.
So, like if somebody said, well, Wojo is actually really bad calling timeout plays after timeouts. Well, somebody like has data to show, like paint touches has data. Actually, Wojo is one of the best in college basketball at calling timeout plays out of timeouts. So I think, yeah, we're going to bring a couple takes and with some data to at least back it up to see kind of where we're coming from on it. And then we're going to move ahead and look to the games coming up this week. The game against Xavier and then don't you dare lose to DePaul.
Oh, God.
But the thing that was dominating my basketball mind before Sunday, and I think for many Marquette fans, was the end of the Butler game. And I think Wojo teams had this amazing ability, Phil, to raise expectations to a certain level, either over the course of the game or over the course of a season, so the expectations are maybe higher than where they began, and then fall short of that, and then leave us disappointed when we really should be accepting of it. So, like, in other words, we went into Friday thinking we're probably going to lose to Butler. And last week's podcast, we said 1-1 this week is probably likely. Beat St. John's, lose to Butler. And that's exactly what happened. So we should be feeling pretty good, all things considered. But the way that Butler game went down on Friday, I think just left so many people spinning their head. And, of course, the most prominent thing...
Speaking
the most
of Leroy Jenkins.
Yeah, look, let's just dive into it. The fact that Wojo did not know the score and called a timeout, or not a call, but he called for an intentional foul in a tie game with 20 seconds left to give Butler the lead. They got away with it, I'll say that, because Kobe McEwen hit a big three to bail him out of that. But just because you hit on 20 and get an ace doesn't mean you made a great call. It's just something that I was struggling with the day after the game, Phil, thinking, man, our head coach did not know the score in a tie game.
Well, I dare say a Wojo defender, right?
Right.
This is indefensible, and here's really what did it for me. And it kind of took me like 5 minutes after the press conference where Wojo announced, yeah, I thought we were down by two. That's my bad. And hey, he owned it. Great.
I will say that. He didn't make up some BS excuse and like blame it on somebody else or anything like that. He did own it, and so we can move past that as quickly as you possibly can. The fact that he said, own it, my mistake, I'd like to move on. But for the sake of this podcast, I can't move on just yet.
Well, and so he said it, and I went, okay. And he said, I thought we were – last time I looked up, we were down two. And then, like, I was still processing, and my brain, like, 5 minutes later, I was like, wait, what? We were never down. We were never until the end – until – Baldwin went and hit the first of the two free throws on the intentional foul. Marquette never trailed that entire half. Mm-hmm. So, like, not only did Wojo not know the score, he, like, invented a score in his head that never existed. Like, it's baffling.
Yeah, like, so, like, when it happened and he called for the intentional foul, see, like, I don't study analytics. I'm guessing I'm, like, maybe most of you, you don't exactly like take time out of your day and study analytics and percentages and odds and things like this. You kind of like learn it on the fly. Like an example, I think the analytics and the probability things are becoming much more prevalent and popular in football.
Yes.
Like the first time I saw a team in football down 14, score a touchdown and go for two, my knee-jerk reaction was, well, that's dumb. Why not just get within seven? And then you could tie the game with another touchdown, where then someone explains the analytics to me, like, well, actually, if you go for two, your odds of winning the game are significantly greater than chancing it in a 50-50 overtime, yada, yada. I'm like, okay, well, I learned something today. And so now I understand that. I was thinking when he did that intentional foul thing, it's like, am I about to learn something in basketball analytics? Is this something next level that I'm going to learn today? Because this seems really dumb to me. And so I was like kind of holding my breath for press conference, like the post game, like somebody was to say, well, actually, Joe, Marquette's odds of winning went up significantly because of that intentional foul, because of this. I'm like, but no, that's not what happened at all.
Right. Well, like,
he forgot the he didn't know the score. And, you know, something I thought about the other day, there was a timeout before that. There was about 40 seconds left,
yep.
45 seconds left. And I remember even throwing it out on Twitter thinking, hey, is this a spot for a 2-for-1 here?
Yep.
In a tie game with 45 seconds left. And I'm thinking, did the play call that he drew up it had to be with the mind that they were down two. So like I would think approaching that situation is a little different as far as the play you draw up, depending on whether you're tied or whether you're down two. Because I think if you're tied, maybe a 2-for-1 comes into play. Because, you know, granted, a 2-for-1, that first shot is generally, maybe you're a little rushed. But if there's one thing I have confidence in with Wojo is that he is good in out-of-timeout plays.
Right.
I was totally confident that with 45 seconds left or whatever it was, about, I think it was like 44 seconds, he could have drawn up a play to get a good look for someone within 5 seconds. Maybe it goes in, maybe it doesn't. But the point is, he would get the ball back because Butler would use the entire shot clock to tie it. But I think if you're down two in that situation, which Wojo thought they were, you're not going to rush that first shot. You're going to take your time and get the best shot you possibly can because you've got to tie the game. And that's like, well, when they started the play after the timeout, they were obviously taking their time. Like, okay, well, they're just not going to go 2-for-1. I didn't think anything else of it, but that kind of occurred to me the other day, like, you know, he didn't know the score, and that probably went into his decision-making in the play he drew up.
Well, so there's a couple of things here. One, okay, why didn't the bench know, right? Like, why didn't an assistant be like, coach, what do we think about going 2-for-1? Or, hey, we're tied. What are we doing? You know what I mean? Like,
well, I think they all just assumed. They probably all just assumed, like tracking the score is not something assistant coaches are probably used to doing. Like assistant coaches, from what I know, like the number one thing, they keep track of fouls, right? They say, you know, hey, Wojo, Theo's got two. All right, well, we got to sit him down. Like they keep track of things, like, you know, statistics if they're relevant to the game. But I don't know if they track anything other than that as far as minutes played. It's like, hey, it's time to get Greg, you know, time to get Marcus out or whatever. But I don't think they've ever been at, like, I don't, to my knowledge, assistant coaches don't say, hey, coach, we're down two. Or, hey, coach, the score is right now. I think they all just probably went in that huddle thinking, assuming Wojo knew the score, say, all right, well, this is what Wojo's our guy. He's the head coach. This is what he wants to do, so let's do it. And but, yeah, like, the next time they're in a huddle, those guys, they're probably not going to be jerks about it, but they have to, like, somebody's, I guarantee he's going to say, hey, coach, we're tied right now.
Like, just so you know, right, coach, like, it's 2 minutes gone and we're up three.
You know, it's like you ever do something like make a mistake like as a kid, and your parents just never let you forget about it, and they remind you about it. Like maybe you left your backpack at school, and like for every day, like, hey, don't forget to bring your backpack home today. Like, thanks. Yes, I know. I made it one mistake. We'll just gonna have to deal with that for a while. Like guys are gonna be like, Coach, all right, we're tied right now. Coach, we're down two. Coach, we're up two. Like, I got it. But I think he's going to have to live with that for a while.
Well, he should probably also make sure his assistants let him know that Marcus Howard has gone 1-for-15 from three in the second half, or you know, something like that. Because that was like, so the intentional foul. All right, fine. It was what it was. But Kamir Baldwin missed the second free throw, And then Marcus proceeds to rush a three with two guys covering him. They fouled again, and then Kobe McEwen hits a miraculous three to send it in overtime. But like, just the like play calling and the, especially in the last 5 minutes, the decision making from Marcus was head scratching. I mean, do you know, again, the really bad, like we just have to say, the just confounding coaching at the end of the game with the score and time and all that stuff aside, like, where do you put more blame, Marcus or Wojo, on the way that game ended?
Yeah, see, all right, first of all, the crazy thing about the timeout, it did not cost him the game at all, because
right.
he got a get out of jail free card from McEwen. But yeah, what lost him the game, number one, Marcus played terrible, and two, like, The defense never adjusted. Kamar Baldwin was good, just getting anything he wanted off pick and roll the entire second half, and he really just never made any adjustment late in the game and going into overtime, and Butler was able to get pretty much anything they wanted off pick and roll and won the game. But yeah, like, the thing about Marcus Howard is we love him, and 90% of the time he's great, but you got to deal with that other 10%, and Friday was that. He just had one of those games where he just decided to shoot his way out of a slump, and it hurt his team. And Anonymous Eagle pointed out correctly that after Marcus fell and took that bump, where I guess he fell and he hit his head on a chair, he was drastically different after that. 2-for-14 in the game after that. So maybe he was dealing with a... They haven't said he has a concussion. I haven't heard him ruled out for the Xavier game yet. But maybe he was feeling a little woozy. And maybe the fact is, he was not sharp after that. He was rough. And I think you do have to put that on the coach, because players want to play, man. And Marcus Howard he's a baller. I mean, he's like number one in the country in usage, I think. Number two and number one in percentage of shots. Number two in percentage of possessions, number one in percentage of shots. So he's used to shooting and used to dominating the game, and that's fine, because for the most part it does work out for Marquette, but sometimes it doesn't. And when he's ice cold like that, the coach has to take control and say, Marcus, you're hurting us a little right now, man. And you got to sit him, as much as it kills you to say you got to take Marcus Howard out of a game that's close, maybe you do need to sit him for a minute and just say, bro, you know, you're 0 for your last 7 here, and you're taking some really bad shots.
Right.
Just take a breath and be the you that has been so great for 3.5 years now. This is not you. Let's settle down and win this game. And that just did not seem to happen in that Butler game. Wojo seemed content to let Marcus shoot his way out of it. And yeah, that last play of regulation, they're like, the brakes were off. It's like, or the next to last possession of regulation, when after the missed free throw, Marcus just came down and just boom,
just
brick.
And like, yeah, just threw up a brick. Well, and that's the crazy thing is that, like, there were plays, and even if you run them for Marcus, and this you mentioned the Kamir Baldwin, you know, Butler ran like 10 pick and rolls in a row, and Marquette adjusted in terms of who they had on Baldwin, but they never did anything crazy like try and double. Like, I would have forced the ball out of his hands. At that point, he's killing you. Like, let anyone else beat you but him. But Butler said, all right, we're just going to keep running this play till you stop it, right? And there were two or three plays that Marquette ran successfully. There was the play that they ran twice, where once it was Marcus coming off the screen into the low post with Sakar in the corner, and they ran the same play with Kobe you know, doing the dribble action towards the basket, and Sakar's man helped off, and Sakar hit two threes as a result, right? Run that play again. You know, there, run Marcus around a double screen on the outside. There's any number of run a play. You have been successful. Whereas it seemed like in the last minute or two, you know, I've used this metaphor repeatedly, but it just sticks with me for some reason. Wojo seemed like he was the Russian coach at the end of, or the Soviet coach at the end of Miracle, like playing with his eyebrow because he didn't know what else to do.
Yeah, it seemed to be a bit of a panic. And once, Butler took control, you just didn't feel like they were going to get it back. And that was the maddening part. I mean, what, they let, a 9-point lead slip away?
Yeah.
Marquette did in the second half of that game.
The largest lead they had was 9 with 13:41 left, and they were up 6 with 2:36 left.
Yeah, so a missed opportunity. And, you know, we didn't, at least I did not expect Marquette to win going into that game because Butler is one of the, you know, top teams in the country. There, I mean, granted they had been on a bit of a slump, but I fully expected to lose that game. But the fact that Marquette was in a position to win it and probably should have won it with a little better execution in the last 5-10 minutes of that game is just what sticks with you. It's like, man, just another missed opportunity that prevents this team from taking a step forward and really being really good. They're just kind of stuck in the middle of the Big East with missed opportunities like that for right now.
Yeah, well, and this whole thing with Wojo, you know, and the decisions, and this was obviously like a unique scenario, right, in terms of the way it happened. But it's also not, you know, you see it all the time on Twitter and the various Marquette fandom areas, you know, oh, Wojo doesn't adjust. And so I spent Saturday thinking about it, and I was like, you know what? Wojo does adjust. Like, we can point to times in games or, at, like we said, out of the timeouts. Or, you know, there was I think it was even at the end of the second half of the Butler game where Wojo, on the last possession, all of a sudden switched to a quick 2-3 and it stifled Butler and they didn't know what to do, right? So he adjusts. But go ahead.
No, I was going to say, he did that in another game recently, too. I want to say it was in the Georgetown game or maybe the – going all the way back to the Providence game, maybe, that he switched to his own lane. Yeah, it was the end of regulation against Providence, when Providence could have got a shot off, and they switched to his own and didn't, and then Marquette ended up losing in overtime. But, yeah, Wojo has, I think that stuck with me in the Butler game. Say, like, hey, Wojo switched to zone at an end-of-game situation again.
Right. And so he makes adjustments, but it didn't seem – so this led to my – what I'm referring to as my grand unified theory of Wojo. In that, I think Wojo has all the capabilities of a coach, of a good coach, right? Like, he can adjust out of timeouts, he can recruit, all that stuff. But my theory is that in the closing moments, when the pucker factor is high, for whatever reason, as a coach, he just freezes up. So I actually did some research, and I kind of went and I'll probably it's much better visually at some point, so I'll probably do a blog post about it or something. But I basically went out and I looked at all 6 seasons of Wojo's tenure at Marquette, and I looked at every game and I said, which are close games, right? 5 or 6 points either way, with 4 or 5 minutes left, right? Competitive games at the end of games. And I was assuming I was going to see a series of games where, yeah, we never just we never won the close games. And generally, in the first couple of the seasons in the Wojo era, that's generally true. In that, you know, with the exception of this second season, every other season, Wojo was right around 50-50 on winning tight games. But weirdly, in season 2, which was the Ellenson year, and his current season, he has won more than 70% of the tight games. Now, this season, obviously, the Providence game and the Butler game come to mind as ones he lost. But those are the only 2 tight games he lost. You know, he say what you will about beating, you know, being in the game against Robert Morris, but he won the Robert Morris game. They won the Georgetown game. There's a couple other games I'm forgetting right now. So I guess this is what makes it even more inexplicable. I think the Wojo is learning to coach Enda games better. He's just had two inexplicable, like, just screw ups this season.
He has, and the late game collapses and late season collapse last year certainly kind of feeds into the fire there of being able to finish, I think. And I think that's a kind of perception that stuck with people from last season, and I think maybe we're paying a little closer attention this year. Like, can this team finish? Can this, or this can take a step up and maybe win some tough games?
Yeah, well, that's great context. If you go, but if you take out the tight games at the end of the season, Wojo was 7-1 in tight games prior to that collapse at the end of the season, with the one being a weirdly out of sort St. John's game in the middle of the season, right? So he was winning the tight games. It's not like he suddenly forgot about it. So I don't know what to make of it.
Yeah. So basically, to kind of summarize again, this, like you said, is probably a little better visually, but going through all of your data that, so maybe you kind of came in with a take of, is Wojo good or bad late in games? And generally you've kind of come out with the conclusion that they've won more, like they've won most of them. They just don't win all of them. It's just maybe the ones that they lose really stick with you more than the ones that they win.
Right. It's almost like the ones that they lose in like very obvious ways that so that looks more noise. It's noise, but it actually looks like the signal, if you will, right? Especially this season. You know, previous season he's won a little bit more than 50-50, but it certainly isn't the like, he can't coach, he loses all the close games. That's not a universal truth by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, as far as like close games this year, maybe no one's going to remember the Georgetown game, but everyone's going to remember the Butler game.
Exactly. Right, like everyone's going to point to Providence and Butler and say, look, he can't win the close games or he screws up. And admittedly, both of those games, absolutely that's on Wojo more than anyone. You know, we can make arguments. You know, Marcus Howard certainly was a contributor in the Butler collapse. But, you know, hey, he's a 20-year-old dude. At some point, the adults in the room have to be like, hey, let's do a little less shooting out there, right? But we're not going to point to the games we won that were close or that the coaching made the difference, because we just don't like nice things. I don't know. We've just gotten too negative, it feels like, at times.
I think that's fair. We're a very ornery bunch. We get feisty over when we get so close to this team being good, and we just keep falling. Seems like a step short. But yeah, I think the losses maybe do stick on Wojo more than the wins. That may be a fair assessment. So, you know, we've mentioned Marcus a couple times, and kind of my little research project over the weekend was, and this is kind of one of those things where maybe by observation, maybe you have this take, but you really want some stats to back it up. And my general, like, I've always kind of thought, like, as incredible as Marcus Howard is, I just don't recall him, like, hitting a lot of big shots late in games and being just have that killer instinct, a Mamba mentality, if you will, that late in games, that if he's taking the shot to win the game or to, you know, give you a late lead, that he's going to hit that shot. I went back two seasons. I didn't do his freshman season soft because he's sharing a lot of shots with Rousey those seasons, and also I'm kind of lazy. But so I wanted to do the past two seasons, kind of like you, a very subjective take on what is a close game and what is clutch time, right? What is like the really clutch shots. I think like a guy like Miles Powell gets more hype than Marcus, one, because his team wins, but also Miles Powell kind of has a rep as a guy who's going to hit that shot. Right. That if he's taking a shot to win the game, you're really sweating when that ball's in the air because it's going in, probably. So I took games from the last two seasons when it was a six-point game or closer in the final 2 minutes. And I basically took Marcus' stats from that point on, so including overtime. So in games that went to overtime, I gave Marcus all of overtime. So what I got, his field goal percentage in those games was 35%. Three-point percentage, 28.5%, so well below his season average, career average, for an effective field goal percentage of 43.1%, which is not great. But now I have to say this is far from conclusive, because there are some variables here, because he had an absolutely terrible game against Providence in which he may or may not, or against Butler, in which he may or may not have been concussed when he was 0 for 7 in the final 2 minutes in overtime, 0 for 6 from 3. So that weighed heavily. And also, I have to concede that he was probably playing with some type of injury late in the season last year during Marquette's collapse when his numbers were similarly bad. Late in games and his three-point percentage. He only made, in the grand collapse last season, he only made 1 3 late in games, starting with Villanova. So at Villanova, Creighton, at Seton Hall, Georgetown, and then the Big East game against Seton Hall. So all those games that were, I would deem, close by my unofficial metric, he made 1 3 out of, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 8. So he was 1 of 8 late in those games. So just my little project here. Marcus, for whatever reason, has not hit the big shot late in games. And I don't know if that's him rushing things, if it's just a coincidence. Maybe the data is not conclusive enough. And again, there are variables considering he may have been dealing with injuries late last season and possibly maybe head injuries, overstating it. But he was not right at the end of the Butler game. But the numbers are what they are. And I don't know what else to make of it. What do you draw from that, Phil?
Well, I will say this. You mentioned, during the great collapse, which, by the way, going through all those stats of that was just, that was not fun. But, you mentioned, he hit one three in crunch time against Georgetown. That was it. But he ultimately, I'm just doing mind math right now, he made – in all those same losses, he made 17 threes. So he was not, while he wasn't, fully Marcus, we can all admit he was hurt, but he was still capable of meeting threes or making the threes. He did them in the flow of the game. It's right. Just when it mattered, he wasn't. And I really wonder, again, this is your statistics kind of, to me, back up the eye test, right? The eye test, I felt by the end of last season that Marcus is terrific. He's just not clutch, right? And I'm not saying that somehow he's an awful player and you should bench him for the last 2 minutes. I don't think he necessarily exceeds, with noticeable exceptions, right? The Providence game last year when he scored 14, the last 14 points for the team in overtime and stuff like that. There are certainly games where he steps up, but I think collectively he has not stepped up in games more than he has stepped up in crunch time in games.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I just wish the end of game statistics were more consistent with his career averages.
Right.
Because if so, because this is just something that kind of occurred to me as he was struggling in the Butler game, just towards the end there, is he just, he just kept missing shots.
Now, how much of that, we talked about it with the, that at some point the adults in the room have to be like, hey, Marcus, you haven't hit anything, let's pass the ball or do something else. How much of that do you put on Marcus is trying to win it and just – they're not drawing up good things, or they don't have the right coaching going on in practice for end of game situations, and Marcus is deciding to go hero ball? And how much of it, I guess how much do you put on the player and how much do you put in the coach in that kind of context, if we assume that the data kind of shows that maybe he's not clutch?
I would say you got to put a little bit on both, because I think no matter how much of a competitor you are, you got to realize when you're hurting your team.
Right.
And you can say man, I'm struggling right now. But I think the competitors in you is always going to say, look, man, I'm going to pull myself out of this. I am so much better than this. And, but he, like he, but at the same time, I think he's always going to want to say, like, yeah, I can, I'm going to shoot my way out of this. I'm going to hit my, I've missed my last four. I'm making this next one.
And I just want to point out, like, the one thing, at no point do I think, like, Marcus is doing this to be greedy or is like, oh, I'm the star, right? Like, he just, from an honest position, I really think in any other context, he's the right person to be taking shots. But just in these clutch situations, he's proven less likely to hit them than you would think.
Yeah, it's just, it's a thing that, like kind of like a player who has a reputation or a coach who has a reputation for not winning the big one. Well, you think he's so great all the other times, eventually it's going to hit, right? And like a guy like Jay Wright, is a guy I bring up as that example for so long. He's like, Jay Wright had that label of like, man, he's a great coach in the regular season, but man, his team's just
him and Tony Bennett.
Yeah, both of those guys, exactly. Tony Bennett's another great example. They don't have those reps anymore because it eventually hit for him. And yeah, I'm just waiting for it to hit for Marcus, for him to have that huge moment when, yeah, maybe he hits a big buzzer beater, or maybe, like, yeah, his team's down two late in the game, and he nails a three and wins the game, or gives him a late lead, and just totally sucks the life out of a visiting arena like he could have if he would have knocked that thing down against Butler on Friday. But, yeah, I don't think, I agree. He's not, it's not like he's incapable of it. I just think the data is just skewing so far to the negative. I'm just, it's got to come back the other way at some point. Again, I haven't seen anybody say that he was hurt for sure against Butler. But if he is, I hope whatever he's dealt with is past him, because if he's not right the rest of the season, that could be very problematic for the rest of Big East, the 10 games Marquette has left in Big East play, because they're going to need him at his best. I hope this doesn't come off as too much complaining, because like I said, 90% of the time, he is great. 95% of the time he's great. It's just, you got to deal with that other 5-10%.
And it's going to show up off in those glaring ways, right? It's just noticeable. Right. The 5% is noticeable.
Similar to what we were just talking about with Wojo. People seem to remember those losses. Maybe they don't give him enough credit for the wins, and maybe we're not, this whole thing is not giving Marcus really any credit for, dropping 40 points and a half or something, or, 30, scoring 30 in the first 35 minutes of a game, but just narrowing down the closing time. But, you need closing time if you want to win. And he's going to have a few of those if he wants to get a few big wins down the stretch. He's got another matchup with Seton Hall coming up. He's got a road trip to Villanova coming up, and he's got the Big East tournament still, and then hopefully the NCAA tournament. And you would like to see him hit those shots in those big moments, and hopefully this data swings back the other way when we get to that point.
Yeah, I mean, all we can do is hope. I mean, it's interesting because, again, if you step back 10,000 feet to 10,000 feet, like you said when we started this segment, the Butler loss was kind of always that seems likely. I think universally coming into the conference play, I think every Marquette fan would have said Friday night, Hinkle Field House playing Butler, who at the time was like 5 in the country. Yeah, we're probably not going to win that game, right? This just seems like a whole new level of two steps forward, one step back, because they raised expectations. We thought we were going to win at Butler. That was going to be tremendous. And then they found a whole new way to take a step back. And it's like, okay, now you're waiting for the other shoe to drop. But the interesting thing is, like, we also got to balance it, because, again, I don't think we need to, like, this whole, like, fire Wojo and, like, everybody's out to, like, I just, like, Marquette Twitter needs to collectively just breathe, because let's see where the season goes. Because right now on KenPom, with the exception of the at Villanova game, Marquette is at least a 50% probability to win the game. So theoretically, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but there's a world where Marquette goes, 9-1 down the stretch, and if they finish 13-5, well, geez, that's a whole other thing, right? Like,
yeah, I mean that might be good enough to win the league,
right?
The way Seton Hall and Nova are going, it may be 15-3 might win the league actually, but I don't know. But yeah, you're right. But that prediction is there. And looking game by game, yes. At Villanova is the one game that you look at and say, yeah, we're definitely losing that one. But the others, you would think all are winnable if Marquette is not just favored outright. You know, the Xavier game keeps going back and forth as a 50-50 game. This upcoming road game, currently Marquette's a one-point favorite on KenPom. They are currently a one-point dog at home to Seton Hall on the 29th, which I have said, February 29th, which I have said, you just got to win that game. I don't care if you're a 10-point dog at home. That's Seton Hall. That's the home game. That's Marcus Howard's last game in the Fiserv Forum. You win that freaking game. So I am just banking on good karma for that Marquette could beat Seton Hall on February 29th. And, you know, Butler, you know, there are some other games that are 50-50 that could go the other way. Yeah, currently game-by-game projected 8-2 the rest of the way, but the actual overall projection is Marquette going 6-4 the rest of the way. So acknowledging some variance there, probably lose some games you're probably supposed to win, but they're all looking like they're so close. And Marquette is just a hard team to project because you're not 100% sure which one's showing up. On what night you're going to get a good shooting night from Brendan Bailey, on what night you're going to be able to keep Theo John and Jace Johnson out of foul trouble. And you're always hoping that the best version of Marcus Howard shows up, and he has almost every game. But on those games when he struggles, then I think panic mode sets in and you wonder how the heck you're going to win that thing. But yeah, like, you said, a step forward and a step back. They didn't so much take a step back against Butler as they just didn't move forward. They just kind of stayed neutral.
Right.
It was disappointing to lose to Butler, but that is in no shape or form a season-crushing loss. It's just frustrating. It's like, oh, we almost had this great thing. Well, we didn't get the great thing, but that doesn't mean things are terrible. We just didn't get this great win. So you're right at 500, 4-4 in the league. Two winnable games coming up before a rematch with Butler on February 9th.
For National Marquette Day. Yep. And we get a 8 days rest between the DePaul game and the Butler game, which means hopefully, and part of the angst, I think, was because Butler was shorthanded. Their starting point guard was out injured, as well as one of their forwards is out with an ACL tear. But Marquette was shorthanded too, right? I mean, gold status has left the team.
Ed Morrow's not coming back yet.
Ed Morrow's not coming back. And Greg Elliott, which, I mean, he wasn't playing max minutes, but he was – he was a very good on-the-ball defender. I would argue at the end of the game in the pick-and-roll situations that Greg Elliott absolutely is guarding Kamir Baldwin with his length. And also a solid three-point shooter. So, like, we can't ignore those minutes that we're missing there, too. So
yeah, Greg Elliott is a valuable piece, man. And granted, he doesn't play a ton of minutes. But just for Wojo to have that option, if one of his guards is struggling, whether it's Kobe McEwen or Marcus Howard. Just to have another guy to throw out there who is capable both offensively and defensively. Well, I don't know if Greg Elliott's ever going to be a star, but he is a valuable role player, and he's an important guy to have, and it just sucks that Marquette doesn't have him right now.
Right. And I mean, Marquette basically went to a six-man rotation in the second half of the Butler game because they had to. I mean, Samir got a little bit of run, but it was because of Jace Johnson's foul trouble. It was Theo, Brendan, Jamal, Sakar, Kobe, and Marcus. That was it, right? Like, that was the rotation. Having a Greg Elliott there, you're giving Marcus maybe a little more rest, or you're giving, some more pieces that you can move around. But
yeah, and if you do want to either bring a guy like McEwen or Howard to the bench for 1 minute just to talk to him. Like, Greg Elliott can give you that 1 minute. Whereas if you need to talk to him during the game, you need to call a timeout. Whereas, just to have that guy to just sub in, he's not going to screw up. He's going to do his job. Just if you need to talk to one of your guards who are struggling.
Right. Yep. So we'll see. I mean, I think people, I understand we were all pretty devastated by loss, especially the way it happened, and thought about it for a while. But I really think we've got to find a way to get a little less. I mean, I'm going to be completely frank. I muted some people on Twitter because I could not deal with the toxicity and the like, all the oh woe is us and Wojo sucks and all this stuff. Like, I get it. Like, I understand it's not ideal, but we got a lot of season left, and you know, we've talked about it. It feels like ad nauseum. We don't know that it'll happen, but if, you know, if Marquette goes 9-1 to end the conference season, that feels pretty good, right? Like, that's good coaching from Wojo. If Marquette makes it to the tournament and gets to the Sweet 16, is he redeemed? He won two games in a row to get to the Sweet 16. Is he now a good coach again? Like, that
he would be in a lot of people's minds. Right. And we've talked about that on this podcast before. The success in the tournament grossly, and maybe failures in the tournament, goes both ways. But what you do in the tournament greatly exaggerates your reputation as a coach. Either you're a winner or you're a choker, based on how you do it. Yeah, if Wojo goes to Dayton, you know, but he wins three games going to Dayton, people would be singing his praises. Oh, he's done it. He has done it. Whereas getting to the tournament by being a bubble team, being the last team in, is not something I would necessarily celebrate as like a big step forward for the program. But if you win two games, you get out of Dayton and then you win two games, that changes the perspective so much, as opposed to like if he won out, if he won, you know, 10 in a row here, so he finished. If he went 14-4, so if he won 10 in a row here, but then got upset in the first round, then he would have that loser choker, you know, reputation stuck on him because he didn't win the tournament game despite winning the last 10 regular season games. So yeah, that fair or unfair, how you do in the tournament greatly exaggerates your reputation as a coach. But you know, like you said, the possibility of 9-1. I would even dial that back to a more modest but possible 7-3. That puts you at 11-7 in the Big East. I mean, that's pretty decent to me for what I expected of this team. Maybe some expected better, but 11-7 in the Big East, if Marquette could pull that off, I would say that's a pretty nice run for this team.
Yeah, it's nothing to sneeze at, right? I mean, that's got to be good for a top three finish. Is it where we thought it would be? Yeah, certainly not quite to where my expectations were, but I mean,
it's for a league that is like in a position that it could get eight teams in the league. Now, I think some of the latest bracketologies have five, which seems low to me.
Yeah.
Like there's like I've said, you know, and I get it. It's what the numbers are kind of showing you right now. But 12 teams out of the Big Ten seems ridiculous to me. That just seems like so many freaking teams. And like that's what's clogging up, jamming up everybody else, and why the Big East only got five in there right now. But to me, the Big East has got to have at least six, probably seven teams, because this is a deep league. This is tough. I get it. There's some teams at the bottom that are only going to finish with like four, five, six wins in the league, but you know, not everybody can get 10 wins. It's just the math doesn't work that way. So, but this league is deep, and I think the metrics show that it's one of the deepest, toughest leagues in college basketball this season. And if Marquette could scratch out 11 wins in this league, I would say that's a pretty decent run. It's not a championship run, but I would see that would be a pretty good job. And I think it's certainly achievable.
Yeah, I agree. So, I mean, we got to see how the season plays out. We got a couple of games in front of us this week, but let's just hang on a touch. Like,
let's touch on those two games while, you know, before we get out of here is, if they're going to, you know, get to that 10-win mark in the league. Starting with two this week would be a great start. Getting a road win is always a good thing. And, you know, Marquette getting round two with Xavier, a team they blew out the first time. And, you know, the metrics proved true on Xavier and their three-point shooting. They were absolutely abysmal in that game. And if we can get a repeat performance of that, I would be very confident in going to Cincinnati and getting a road win against Xavier. The X factor for me, of course, Phil, is Marcus Howard's health. I have not heard anything to the contrary, but I am just nervous the way he finished that Butler game that he may not be right. I hope he is. And if he is, and Marquette's three-point shooting is on par with what it has been for the majority of the season, and if Xavier is similarly bad to the way they have been all season from the three-point line, I think Marquette is very capable of getting this road win.
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, Creighton's played two games since they beat Georgetown, which was, you know, a little bit surprising, but then lost to Creighton.
Yeah. Xavier, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, Xavier. I'm talking about Xavier. Yeah. But I haven't seen anything that makes me say all that much has changed from when these two teams last met, right?
Right.
You know, and in fact, it's going to be a wider, whether this matters or not. Marquette's going to have, you know, essentially an extra 48 hours of rest because Xavier played on Sunday and we're playing them on Wednesday and Marquette played on Friday, right? So it's not that it's a bye, but it's a little mini break that maybe helps Marquette be a little fresher. And like you said, if Marcus is good to go and healthy, I don't see any reason. Certainly a home game for Xavier is going to make a difference. I don't think Paul Scruggs is going to get in foul trouble in the first 2 minutes and not play much in the first half. I don't think it's going to go down that way again. I think it's going to be a tighter game, but I don't see any reason why Marquette can't win this game on the road. You know, maybe a tighter than you might like, 5 or 6 points or something like that.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of liking the KenPom projection of a close one possession win. Of some, KenPom has it 73-72. Not to copycat, I'll go 74-72. How about that?
Okay.
When the 3-point shooting disparity is this great between two teams, the team that's the good 3-point shooting team should always have a chance, because even if you get down big, you could come back quickly against a team that just can't put up that many points in a hurry. Cause, you know, if to remind you guys, Xavier is 327th in the country in 3-point shooting. Now, they're a much better 2-point percentage shooting team than Marquette. I mean, most teams are, but they're not elite by any stretch of the imagination. They're ranked 130th in the country, so they're in the upper half. But certainly, not elite by that. They're just offense is great. They win games with their defense, but they don't force a ton of turnovers. So, which has been an Achilles heel for Marquette in the past. Although maybe the turnover problem has not been as disastrous the last few games once they've gotten into Big East play. So, the 3-point percentage is what I keep coming back to. If both teams shoot the way they have all season, even if Marquette does get down and allows a lot of points in the paint, if their big guys get in foul trouble, their 3-point shooting should allow them to make up ground. And if you get a lead, their 3-point shooting should allow them to pull away, which is what happened in the game in Milwaukee just a few weeks ago. So that's why I'm not confident Marquette's going to get many road wins, but this is one that I think is reachable.
Yep, I agree. I think they win. I'm going to say I'm going to go 71-66.
All right, very good. Hopefully that proves true. Xavier still have it kind of struggling because Xavier's kind of in a mode of, you know, they're 2-5 in the league where, you know, you don't want to get too many more losses because then you're kind of accepting that you're going to be in the basement. You may not be hugging DePaul in the basement, but you're going to be right next to him.
Yeah, I agree. One note, going back to the turnover rate, Marquette's trend is generally down. Like, if you go to a good resource is I'm not going to be able to describe it visually, but if you go to Bart Tvorak, the Marquette's turnover rate has dropped, about 10 points since kind of midway through the season. So they're seemingly starting to get that under control.
Yeah, the big question we got back in non-conference play was which of Marquette's three terrible stats, which was 2-point percentage, turnovers, and offensive rebounding, would improve the most. It seems turnovers has been the answer.
Yeah, turnovers and 2-point percent is kind of hovering right around where it is. And offensive rebounding percent is about the same. So, yeah, it looks like turnovers was the answer. If you had turnovers, so. Please proceed to the window.
You win. I still think offensive rebounding is going to keep getting better because as Jace plays more and more.
Yeah, as he gets